Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. The following is an interview with Daniel T. Kingsley, K-I-N-G-S-L-E-Y, Special Assistant to the President in the White House Personnel Office. The interview was conducted on September 23, 1974, in Mr. Kingsley's office, room 351 of the old Executive Office Building. The interviewer was Susan Yowell. Until now, we haven't had anyone doing it on a regular basis, and just now hired a woman that's doing it 2 days a week, so it's a bit of a slow process. And someday we hope that we'll get them out to everyone and they can make any additional changes or corrections, whatever. But as I said, our information is very basic, and in a few cases we'll probably be repeating things that are already well known, but we'd just like to have an overview.
Well, it's better to overdo it than underdo it. We don't want to have misinformation.
Well,
historical content.
Right. Anyway, you came to the... First of all, I think you worked during the 1968
campaign.
In advancing.
Mm-hmm.
Was this your route to the White House? Had you then... Were you then recruited by someone whom you had known during the campaign?
Well, actually, after the campaign, I then went to... When the president went to Europe in February of 1969, I did the advance in Brussels. I was still in the West Coast in private industry. And after that, I then came to my predecessor, Harry Fleming, and said I would like to, join the administration. So that was the route, and I did join the administration. I didn't come directly to the White House. I went to GSA, and I was a commissioner for the disposal of all surplus property. GSA from May of 69 until I came over here in February of 71.
Okay. Who had originally recruited you as an advance man?
John Whitaker.
And then did you work under Ron Walker also, and it was on a volunteer basis in the 69?
Well, no, actually Walker and I were equals. In other words, 69, they didn't have an advanced staff, a permanent advanced staff for the first 6-8 months. And so in 69, for the European trip, they recruited... For that trip, I guess those they thought were pretty good advance men in the 68 campaign, and there was Walker and myself and Niedecker and Morgan and Henry Cashin and Roy Goodrow. Then in 69, in July, when the president went around the world, they still didn't have a full-time advance staff. So again, they looked around the government to find out where the advance men were, and I left GSA for a month. And Walker was an interior, and they pulled him over, and Cashin was here, and so a lot of the same people did that trip. Then is when they organized the full-time advance staff here, and that's when Walker came over here.
Okay. I was confused. I thought that had been established before then.
No. Mm-mm.
Well, why don't we really... begin then with your assignment when you first came to the staff, and I think Mr. Fleming was still here.
I took his place, yeah. He was...
Was there an overlap period?
No, he actually left the day I came, and he went on a vacation and he came back for a few days. He may have left even a few days before that.
Could you describe the organization of the personnel office when you arrived?
Well, the organization of the personnel... Fleming was the chief of the White House Personnel Office in 69 and 70. And he had the responsibility for the management of all non-career personnel. At the same time, Peter Flanagan was also involved in personnel to a limited degree in terms of very high level appointments and ambassadors and the like. In late 1970, when Malick arrived on the scene, and Malick sort of took over what Fleming was doing, Flanagan. And Fleming continued on with the responsibilities that he had. Malick then created the executive recruiting capability, which we'd never had in the White House, and no previous administration had had that. In effect, you know, full-time executive recruiters going out and looking for people, much as headhunters do for industry. So when I came in, I sort of took Fleming's place. Malick continued on having the recruiters reporting to him. I took over the entire Fleming staff, which included the administration of the personnel office and the liaison staffs, those people that were involved with the departments and agencies on a day-by-day basis in various matters of personnel, whether they be political clearances or patronage, or, you know, in any non-career personnel matter. And so then Flanagan was no longer in the picture. I was running the Fleming operation, reporting to Haldeman through Malick. Malick was in charge of the executive recruiters. Then in 72, when Malick got into the political arena, then I took over the executive recruiters, was in charge of all of the personnel, and reported directly to Haldeman.
How do you distinguish between this executive recruiting operation and the administrative and liaison?
Well, it's just another part of the organization, and the best way to manage it is only to have one person doing it. But the reason I gave you the background was to show you the evolution by which this came about. That's why I got into a little bit of the background. But the personnel office really has an executive recruiting staff, they have administrative staff, and they have a liaison staff, and ought to really properly in an organization come under one head. And executive recruiters are the ones that go out and find top-level people for presidential appointments. That is, you know, cabinet, sub-cabinet, assistant secretaries, regulatory agencies, that kind of thing. Executive recruiters only work in that area. The liaison men are responsible for the day-to-day interaction between the departments and agencies, whether it be executive recruiting, whether it be political clearances, or whether it be just plain patronage where people are looking for jobs in the non-career area. The administrative section, of course, is responsible for all of the political clearances and all of the paper flow in and out that comes, documents that go to the president, proper processing of requests for jobs, so on and so forth. So for a year there, it was somewhat disjointed, and then came under one head after Malick left, and has been that way ever since.
Okay. Is the administrative and liaison staffing portion of the job done essentially the same way it was done when you came and took over Mr. Fleming's?
No, because of the two-headed, I wasn't going to say monster, but the arrangement we had, the liaison, the recruiters who were working for Malick, interfaced themselves with the departments and agencies on those assignments that they had. The liaison people interfaced on everything else, and this created problems. This created frictions. And since the time that there's only been one head, the executive recruiters have not interfaced directly with the departments and agencies, but have done so through the liaison people, so that a department or agency would only look one person for all non-career matters that they were involved in with the White House. And organizationally, that's a much better way to do it, both from the point of the departments and agencies and from the point of view of internal, you know, organization and things running smoothly.
Okay.
But it you have to understand the historical evolution to know why it happened this way.
Right. I know that it really occurs in both ways, but could you run through briefly a description of how one is recruited for an executive level position?
For a presidential appointment? Well, if let's say that there's a need for an assistant secretary of HEW for education, and that vacancy comes up, and the White House personnel office would then have the assignment to go search for an assistant secretary of education. Now, maybe at the same time that the secretary of education is also looking himself, which is fine, because the point of the White House personnel recruiting staff is to be is to provide a service for the secretary, because although the assistant secretary will be a presidential appointment, he or she also has to work for the secretary of HEW. So you give one of your recruiters an assignment, and you might say, you know, you give him or her the priority and the criteria, and say, now this is the profile we want. Now, you know, let's find a candidate and let's do it in 3 weeks. You might say, in this case, we're looking for a woman. We think we ought to be an assistant secretary of education who's a woman. It's a good spot for a woman, which is happens to be the case. And so you're given this assignment. You, as the manager of the department, you monitor it. Candidates are brought in. You finally come to a list of 3 or 4 candidates. You have them interviewed by the secretary of the department. Hopefully you, as the president's representative, and the secretary of the department agree on the best candidate. You then send a staffing memo around to the senior White House staff, hopefully to get their concurrence, and then you send a memo to the president recommending such and such a person for that job. That's basically how it works.
Who determines or who establishes what the ideal profile is for an executive appointment?
Well, that's established usually by the personnel chief in consultation with the secretary of the department and or his representative, maybe the undersecretary, or maybe in case of assistant secretary, and possibly the head of the domestic council, the substantive person on the White House side, and in consultation with those two people and possibly others, you come up with a criteria. You don't decide it arbitrarily because you're not really in a position to do so, but it's your job to determine it after talking to those people that should know.
Could you estimate whether there was more emphasis or more occasion when you were looking for a specific person to fit a specific job, or whether you were often on the other end of having this talent bank of people?
The requests of people for jobs? Right. Which took the most time?
Well, which was there more emphasis on in the personal office?
Well, let me see how they are both important. In other words, the executive recruiting probably only took 15% or 20% of the time. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that there was more emphasis. It's just that there is, in the patronage side of it, there's so much paper and so many demands that it takes a great deal of staff and it takes a great deal of time just to process that and keep people happy. Because, you know, there are only 3,000 non-career jobs in the federal government, of which 1,200 are U.S. justices and marshals. So out of the whole federal bureaucracy, there are only 1,800 non-career jobs. Well, there are certainly a lot more demands, I mean, by Congress, by the Republican National Committee, by the senior staff, and by others. You just get demands all the time, people wanting jobs. So because of that demand, because of you're there to service that demand, a large proportion of your time is spent doing that very thing. Not that that's necessarily, in the long run, that's really not as important to the functioning of the federal government in terms of the personnel are going to be involved, but at the same time, if you don't do it, you have everybody and your brother down on your neck, you know. So I really have to give it to you in terms of the percentage of time. Now, in terms of the time spent by the top guy, if 20% of our workload is recruiting and 80% is political clearances and patronage, I certainly would spend a greater percentage than 20% on executive recruiting. In other words, there'd be more delegating in the 80% area. I might spend 50% maybe of my time in managing the executive recruiters than in managing the liaison people and some of the other people that were involved only in patronage. So it would be a higher priority in terms of the chief's job. Maybe that's what you're getting at. Yeah.
Since I brought up the other side of the personnel office, the patronage part of it, I know that a talent bank was developed and quite different from what had been originally used during the time where Mr. Fleming was here. Could you describe the, I guess, birth of that talent bank system and how it was developed?
Yeah, it came to birth under me. We realized that Fleming had files, but he didn't have any kind of a systematic retrieval system. I mean, you could get a guy asking for a job, and you'd write back and say, there's nothing now, but put your file in the talent bank. But then maybe 6 months later, someone would write in or someone would call from a department wanting a systems analyst, GS-14 grade, with an emphasis on this or that. Well, how would you know where he was? I mean, there was just no... So, in January of 72, I initiated the study and then the development of a computerized talent bank. And it took from January until late October to get it completely developed. And I put a fellow, who I'm sure you interviewed before he left here, by the name of Mike Harrigan on it as the project manager. And he was, you know, influential in developing that program and putting it on the computer and getting the terminal in the office and all the things that they supposedly have now.
Okay, that is still in use?
As far as I know. As far as I know, and probably in your interview with him, you probably got a great deal of detail, I would think, as to how that was formulated. But from my point of view, I asked them to. They worked for the National Archives. We got Bert Rhodes involved and his people. And I knew Bert from GSA. And they worked very closely with my people in developing the program and then getting it done. And it was a long, difficult project. But now, supposedly, all of the talent bank is supposed to be on the computer. All of the Schedule C's in government and all non-career people should be on the computer.
Were you involved in recruiting for White House positions? I mean, positions on the White House staff, immediate White House staff, as well as
by request of whoever was in charge of fulfilling that job. It didn't always happen.
It was more on an informal basis.
We were not given authority, or let's put it that way, the policy was not such that anybody who wanted to recruit somebody on the White House staff from another department had to go through the personnel office. That was not the policy. It was done on a case-by-case basis, according to the wishes of those that were doing the staffing.
Since you phrased it that way, were you automatically consulted on any presidential appointments in the departments and agencies? Or were there cases when the appointment was made without this office having their input?
Well, that's kind of a yes and no answer. It's impossible for any appointment to be made without my approval, because A, all presidential appointments have to be cleared by my office, and B, I'm the only one that can make the recommendation to the president, that is, on paper. You know, I'm not saying the cabinet officer can't go to the president and say, I want so-and-so, you know, to be undersecretary. But in fact, all paper, all processing had to be done. Now, to get to the practical answer, there were times when a cabinet officer would say, this is who I want, and that would be it. You know, in other words, the White House would not have had an input into that selection. And this could be as a result of a couple of factors. Number one, if it were a cabinet officer such as Rogers, for example, who had access to Nixon, he might have discussed it with Nixon and that would have been it, you see. And that was just a matter of paper. It could have been a situation where, let's say there was a vacancy in an undersecretary's position, and the secretary wanted a certain assistant secretary to take that position, and when he let it be known, it was obvious to us that that was a good choice, so why bicker about it, you know? That would be another case in point. Of course, you can have situations where a cabinet officer would have selected assistant secretary and we would have disagreed, and then, you know, then the show would have been on the road in terms of going back and forth. So those are two examples of how we might have had minimal input in the selection of a...
However, at some point, it would have had to go through...
Has to go through.
...the personnel office.
Absolutely. An example of where the personnel office is only a paper shuffler, I'll put it that way, are the judges. The judges are selected, the decision process there, it's between the Attorney General and the Senator from that state, and as a practical matter, the Deputy Attorney General. In other words, when Kleindienst was a deputy, that was one of his special responsibilities. And all we would get is a piece of paper saying, from Mitchell to Nixon, saying, recommend Joe Schultz to be a judge, and we were just a rubber stamp.
Is that true in all cases of judges?
Yes.
Or virtually all?
Yes. I would say, oh, that was the Nixon policy when I arrived. The judges were recommended by the Department of Justice, and the personnel office was not involved in the selection of the judges.
You know, just kind of an interesting point, do you happen to know whether in cases where there may have been someone that Mr. Nixon wanted to recommend personally, that he would go through then the Attorney General rather than come through the...
Yeah, we'd get the word, well, it might not go... It could have happened two ways. In fact, there was one case where it did. He could either, or have one of his assistants, call the Attorney General, or talk to the attorney. Or they could call me and tell me to call the Attorney General and pass the word on. But the reason for this is that it gets back to the tradition of the senators. You see, that the senators recommend the judges from the various districts. Mm-hmm. And so we have very little to say. Say there wasn't any Attorney General, which doesn't make any sense really, but we would still have to pretty well take the recommendations of the senators if these people cleared the ABA qualification test, you see. So it really didn't matter that much whether it came from the Attorney General or it came directly from the senators. And might as well let the Attorney General be on the firing line if there were differences of opinion, you know, with the senators over qualifications, as have us do it. In fact, the Justice Department went so far as to, they even did the FBI clearances. Mm-hmm. It even went that far. We initiated the FBI clearances for all other presidential appointments. That is, we didn't do them, but we would go to the counsel's office and Butterfield's office and say, we want to start an FBI clearance. And in the case of the judges, when they came over, they had already been through the FBI. And that was triggered directly from justice.
One of the things that we're interested in obtaining in these interviews is an idea of what staff offices individual staff members coordinated with most frequently. I'm sure that in the area of personnel, you had frequent contact with some of the people in the special interest areas.
Mm-hmm.
Could you go through that and briefly describe your role in coordinating?
Yeah, our role in coordinating with the offices around the building, I would say I'd put it on a two tracks. You'd have what I would call substantive coordination and political coordination. Now, in substantive coordination, of course, we would be coordinating with Ehrlichman for the domestic council, or his designee, Cole, and OMB, whether it was the head of OMB or his deputy. Now, there is some overlap here. There's some additional. For example, in regulatories, we would coordinate with Flanagan's office on the substantive side. In congressional, Assistant Secretary for Congressional Relations, we would coordinate with Timmons' office, who we would also coordinate on in the political side, but I'll get to later. There's an overlap. We would coordinate in the substantive side with Klein and with Colson occasionally. It'd be in communications or in PR. So that's the substantive coordination.
Could you define what you mean by substantive coordination?
Well, if you, let's say that it goes back to what I said about the executive recruiting. Let's say that we have an assistant secretary for education. I would coordinate in terms of developing the criteria. I would coordinate after when I got a list of maybe the final candidate, that I would write a memo or have a telephone conversation. Let whoever was the designee for the domestic council on this particular appointment know who this person was and get a concurrence. So that when we sent the memo to the president, we could say, Assistant Secretary of Education, John Ehrlichman concurred, she said, in this appointment. That's the kind of coordination. Now on the political side, would, of course, I'm not sure whether sometimes it wasn't confrontation as much as coordination, because you could get a candidate that might, you might get a position where some senator or congressman had a candidate. Of course, the East Wing would be very much for that. And then you might have another candidate the Republican National Committee was pushing. And this is what makes this job so mind-boggling and difficult. And then you could get, and then Colson might be pushing some candidate that the NAM liked, for example. And so you coordinated in that sense, but you also had differences of opinion. Now, as to specific coordination, the way I managed it, and it's not being done this way now, and I'm not going to say ours is better than the way it's being done now, but I had what I call a political coordinators meeting. And it was either once a week or once every 2 weeks, depending upon the traffic. And at that meeting would be representatives from Congressional Relations, from Colson Special Interest Groups, from the National Committee, and from Harry Dent's office, who's part of the inside political man. And I would, at that meeting, review with these people lists of candidates, final candidates for both full-time and part-time positions. Because one of the biggest jobs we had in this office, it still is the filling of part-time honorary position boards and commissions, whether it be the Clemency Board or the USO Board or the Board of Visitors of the Air Force or a lot of the Air Quality Advisory Council. So that's the way that I would coordinate with the various political offices, by having a single meeting once a week or every 2 weeks. Now, along with that, we'd have various telephone conversations, you know, numerous conversations on specific personnel actions. But that was an institutionalized meeting that I initiated, and which I understand is going on in the process.
I doubt seriously that your phone calls were documented. Did you write any memos to the file on what recommendation people made?
Well, there were so many. It would depend upon the nature of the position. And,
okay.
You know, we got so many requests for jobs, you know, that if you had Assistant Secretary for Education search, certainly important recommendations should be, you know, in those files. But some guy being recommended for a GS-13 over in the Labor Department wouldn't. If he got the job, he or she would have a file.
What about these political coordinators meetings that you held? Was there any documentation of the individual?
Oh, yes. There was an agenda.
Made at those?
There was an agenda that was drawn up that showed what full-time jobs we were considering at that time, and what part-time boards we were filling. And then at the end of the meeting, I would have one of the staff write up a short minutes at those meetings. Now, on the coordination, there was one other office that we coordinated with, and of course that was the counsel's office for FBI clearances and for conflict of interest checks on presidential appointees.
Was that merely turning over to them the whole area of special interests and so forth, or did you get actively involved
in
any of that?
We would trigger it, and they would do it and come back and say that Joe Blow has no conflict.
Right.
Or
it was just up to them. You just turned.
Absolutely.
Over to them.
Yeah, we did not get involved. There were a couple or three occasions where where Trudy Brown, who was in charge of it at that time, the FBI, would bring a file to me because there was really a political judgment to be made as to whether the person should be cleared. I mean, technically the person had passed the FBI, but the process was that she would, if she saw a red flag, she would then take it to Butterfield, and Butterfield would make a yay or nay decision, but then he might say, you better go, you know, this is really a political decision, you better have Kingsley take a look at it. So I would look at the files only, and only that part of the file. I used to stay outside the door while I read the file, you know. In other words, I remember one case where a man was being hired on the White House staff. And all references were good, but there was one that was derogatory, and I just had to determine, look at the background and see whether maybe that derogatory reference was kind of sour grapes on the basis of these two guys had been in business together and business hadn't worked out well. You know, this happened to be the case, as I remember. But other than that, why we would not make any judgments. So. We had another one that was very interesting. It was on the, this was a part-time, when a cost of living council was set up, there was three subcommittees set up underneath it. One was the rent board, and to advise on the cost of rents and whether they'd be increased and so on. And you try to make these boards as representative as possible, and there's a group called the tenants group. And the tenants group obviously is very low income, you know, a very heavily black group. And the leader of the tenants' organization was a gal by the name of, I think it was Rose Wiley. And very much suspect of being in the numbers racket in Philadelphia, you know. And it really got down to a question, well, you know, maybe something will happen, maybe she'll get indicted. On the other hand, if you don't put her on, you're ignoring the representative of the tenants group. So it was that kind of decision, and we decided to put her on, and she wasn't eventually indicted, and then we took her off. But you know, in the long run, we would have been more trouble if she was indicted, so it was a one-day story. But if we had not put her on as a representative of the tenants, it would have been a great big flop. So I mean, that's the kind of thing occasionally.
Were there other, as you said, institutionalized meetings which you participated in on a regular basis?
Well, I would have regular staff meetings. But in terms of the people outside of the staff?
Either, right.
Well, we'd have regular staff meetings. We'd have the political coordinators meetings. And other than that, it was on a case-by-case basis.
Was there any change in the activity of the personnel office other than just an increased activity with the reorganization after the 72 election?
Was there any change? You said except for what?
I said except for the increased activity, probably.
Except the increased activity?
I'm sure that there was an unusual number.
Well, it was larger staff. But there was one major change. Of course, this is the point that I was getting out of being in charge of it. There was one change that was made that is still in practice and which I strongly disagree with. I don't know if you want that kind of comment at least.
I'll leave that up to you. I said, we're not trying to get it.
No, well, this is a matter, this is not a matter of people. I'm not getting into personality. Prior to post-72 election, the chief of the White House personnel office made the final decision on all of the part-time boards and commissions. And he made the decision, he made the slate, and he sent it to the president. Never went to the chief of staff, you know, mm-hmm. for approval. As full-time presidential appointments did, either chief of staff or the president. Somewhere along the line, after the 72 election, they changed that, and they made the chief of the personnel office send all part-time as well as full-time recommendations to the chief of staff for approval, which I would call a centralization, you know, of the operation. In other words, rather than delegating to them. And I think that's a waste of time for the chief of staff, and I think that that's a mistake, and I think that that's something that the personnel chief should be able to do. So that was a major change that I saw. The other change, excuse me.
Oh, I was just going to try and rephrase my question. I guess my basic question was really that obviously, there were major changes made in the departments in these executive level positions mm-hmm. after the 72 election mm-hmm. and after the resignations.
Yes.
And really, what was the role of the White House Personnel Office in carrying that out?
Well, you mean in filling the jobs?
Yes. And did they have any role in determining what kind of reorganization?
Oh, I see. What people should resign, what people shouldn't resign?
Yes,
they did have a role in that. In 72, there was a very intensive, exhaustive, detailed evaluation done of all presidential appointees. And from that evaluation came certain decisions to accept certain recommendations. The evaluation did not go to the final end and recommend people, you know, be fired or terminated, but it did evaluate people on the basis of their performance. So, to that extent, the personnel office was responsible for providing the material on the basis of which resignations were accepted. And it also did a talent bank recruiting, undertook a talent bank recruiting assignment during that period that led to a high-level talent bank, if you will, for people to replace those that had resigned.
Who were the reports or evaluations submitted to?
Well, the final report was submitted to the president through Haldeman. It was submitted to Haldeman, chief of staff.
And these were on all of the executive level?
All presidential appointments.
All
Do you understand the difference between a presidential appointment and a scheduled state?
I wasn't making a clear
Well,
decision.
I don't mean that.
Yeah.
I'm sure you did. A lot of people don't. And it was only on the presidential appointee level that these records, that these evaluations were done. There's nothing below that. There may have been a few exceptions. For example, the director of the Park Service is not a presidential appointee, but he was evaluated. But by and large, it was a presidential appointee. Mm-hmm. Okay.
In general, would you say that your office files were adequately documenting the activities of your office?
The files that we had? Oh, I think so.
Was, first of all, were the White House personnel office files maintained in one central location?
Mm-hmm.
And did you use central files? White House central
well,
files?
Well, we had central files, and then we had what we call our K files, which were the current files on all appointees in the Nixon administration. And we used primarily K files, but we used central files occasionally.
Did you keep a crime file which would reflect you personally, which would reflect your activities? Or did your secretary?
Yeah, she had a diary, you know, a daily log.
Was this also a log of all of your outgoing and incoming correspondence?
Yes, we had that.
Okay.
We had files, chronological files, we had job description files, and we had people files.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a John Jones is being nominated to the FPC, and so there'd be a John Jones file, but you could also go to the FPC file and find that material, or should be able to find that material. I'm not saying it always happened that way.
No files are ever filled
No.
Would there be any other offices where there would be a substantial number of files relating to your work in the White House? This might have been as a result of a special assignment to work on some task force or even an informal task force.
Well, of course, the Congressional Relations Office would have files for all those requests for jobs,
mm-hmm.
I would think, and those would be reflected by in our files by their passing along that information and copies of correspondence that they sent back to the Hill. The counsel's office would probably reflect the all of the requests for conflict of interest and FBI clearances, but I wouldn't think I can't think of any others.
Mm-hmm. I know that you temporarily left the White House to work on the inaugural campaign.
Yeah, I was responsible for all of the administration.
Okay, just to go back from the beginning, you came here in February of 71
mm-hmm.
as a special assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And then when was it that you did leave?
I never left as a special assistant. I left physically. But I've always been a special assistant to the president from February 8, 1971 until today. Now, I left physically from November 72 until May of 73.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the title and the pay and the records and the access and the mess and everything else, it continued on.
Okay. And who took over your day-to-day responsibilities in the personnel operation while you were...
Well, it was taken over by... Malik came back from the committee to re-elect and took it over for about 2 months, and then Jerry Jones took over from him.
And again, to fill in that gap, could you briefly describe what you were doing during that period you were away from the personnel office?
Well, I was in charge of all the administration of the 1973 inaugural, which in effect meant running it. There was a committee, and there was a chairman and an executive director, and then there were five co-chairmen, vice chairmen, of which I was one. But in fact, it came out that our group, as it was called, pretty much was in charge of, you know, keeping the thing ticking along. Mm-hmm.
Are there any areas that come to mind as being particularly significant that might not be well documented, but which you feel should be talked about in more depth in an oral history project? This could be either a very specific area of a particular appointment that you may have worked on, or are there any more general areas that...
Well, probably the evaluation area, which is very, very, very sensitive. I mean, I'm not sure where the documents are, if there are any in the official files.
Okay. You're talking about the evaluation after the 72 campaign?
Well, before the 72, it was being done in 72. I think that in an oral history project, I think evaluations are important. To go to the limits of final action that this evaluation went to, I'm not sure is a good idea, but I do think that constant evaluations of the performance of your people is a very necessary, you know, management device. And so that to the extent of that evaluation and to the extent it was systematized may not appear. But I think one point that might be a point of analysis and educational dialogue would be, how often should you evaluate and how should you do it in an office like this? Should you have the evaluation function? And if so, how often should you do it, and what should be the objective? You know, that would be something. That's the one that comes to mind.
Okay. Do you have a permanent address where you think you might be reached over the next 10 years or so, in the event we do want to get back to you?
Sure.
Do you have a family address?
Or yes. 10820 Spring Knoll, SpringKnoll Drive, Potomac, 20854. If I ever get confirmed by the Senate, I hope to be there for at least 5 years.
Okay. And that brings up the point. You have been appointed to the Federal Power Commission.
I've been nominated to the Federal Power Commission, and just got my hearing date Friday, which is on October 7th. Okay. So that's what I'm waiting for.
So you're hoping to be over there sometime in the near future?
Yeah, within a month.
Right. Okay. Just one other question. Were there any, I know that there were lots of articles written, I think there was one in the National Journal written on the personnel office. Are there any published descriptions of your work on the White House staff that you know of, which are either particularly good or ones which you would like to discredit in any way? I don't mean to.
Well, I've seen a number of articles of late I like to discredit because they're false, but they're not.
Well. Actually, we just sometimes it's helpful.
There was an article written in the Washington Post, and it's in my scrapbook, and I can get, I have to check the date. It's either December 5 or December 12, 19.
That's close enough if you...
Is that close enough? You don't need to exactly? You know the scrapbook, you know that article that was in the Washington Post with Malik's and my picture on the front page? Can you check and see what the date of that? Well, I got them in here. Oh yeah, just maybe I can find it. Just maybe. Yeah, it was either December 5 or December 12 of the Washington Post, and it was a Sunday article. Started on the front page, and then went over to page 4, and it was the entire page 4 with pictures of everybody in the staff. That was a pretty good article.
You'd say it was fairly accurate.
It was fairly accurate. It kind of got fuzzy at the end, like somebody had been editing him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of, yeah, here it is, kind of interesting because the writer,
Ken Clausen.
That's when he was on the, that's when he was on the Washington Post staff, yeah. And that was the front page. And then the, you know, the rest of this article had the pictures of all the staff covering the top of it. There was the National, there was the National Journal article. But I would say that's the only other one.
And just one other minor question. I know Pat Rick is now your secretary, but who have been your secretaries throughout your...
Well, first gal was Patty Presock, who's, I think, still with the press office somewhere.
I think so.
And Mary Kay Burnett, who's just got married, and I don't know what her address is right now.
Of your secretaries, who would be most familiar with your files, with the system that was used? Or?
At that time?
Mm-hmm.
You mean when I was running the personnel office?
Right, for the majority of the time you were personnel office.
Well, it was about 50-50 between Presock and Burnett, and I suppose either one. Maybe Burnett's just more recent in terms of memory, you know, but either one.
Okay. And I just remembered one thing I didn't ask you. Did you do any speaking on behalf of the administration, or did you do any travel in connection with your job?
Practically none, or none, let me put it that way, with three exceptions. Because the job it just isn't that kind of a job. It's very much of an inside job. The three exceptions were in the 1972 campaign, when I was probably the miniest of all mini surrogate candidates, and I went to Oregon three times, where I'm from, at the request of the local people. And once in September 72 and twice in October. And actually, in those trips, which were different parts of the state, I stuck pretty much to what I do in the White House and that kind of thing. Sort of, you know, a local boy comes home routine, you know.
Okay.
But that was the extent of the traveling. I can't...
And that was also the extent of your public speaking?
Oh, I spoke to the Power Commission awards ceremony once, and I spoke to Princeton alumni group once. But first when you're in this kind of job, you always... And you're speaking, you always talk about the executive recruiting part of it, which is, you know, that's the high level. You never get into the nitty-gritty about the patronage and the political clearances and all that stuff. So I think that a person in that job shouldn't just automatically turn down every request, but I think he or she should not encourage a lot of public speaking, because outsiders really don't properly understand the role of the, you know. It's just like these articles that were in the paper a few days ago, and I don't know if you read them, about the circumvention of the civil service system and all that stuff. Well, And now we're going to have a new policy where we're not going to circumvent the civil service system. Well, we never did circumvent the civil service system. What happened was that in a two or three isolated cases, GSA and HUD, the people that we sent referrals to, you know, misused their authority, and the authority given to them by their department head, not by the White House personnel office. And as a result, some people evidently got civil service jobs that they shouldn't have got. But that really was between the department and the civil service system, because after all, the Civil Service Commission has to approve of everybody that gets on the, you know. So this great new policy is really nothing new at all, and the one to which I am somewhat sensitive, because, you know, just as I said, I think it was a quote Bob Hampton and I used to talk quite often, but never about ways in which we would circumvent the civil service system, because that never was the intent. But at the same time, if you get out and get out front too much in this kind of a job, you can sometimes get trapped in it, where people might get the wrong impression about, you know, what you're doing, which is a perfectly legitimate function in a democratic, small d, you know, government.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm sure that one of these days someone will be back to you with an Nixon Oral History Project. I